You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
Welcome to the ECF staff room. I'm Elaine Long.
And I am Mark Quinn.
We are programme leaders for the UCL Early Career Teacher Development Programme. Why are we in the staff room? We are here because this is where the best professional learning conversations always take place. This is where problems can be aired bluntly and where solutions can be explored.
Over the course of this series, we will hear the voices of different colleagues as they come into the ECF staff room. We will hear from early career teachers themselves and from the mentors and induction tutors who support them. We will talk about all things ECF, the challenges and the joys. So why don't you enjoy a coffee with us, perhaps even grab a biscuit and sit down to half an hour of ECF staff room chat. Welcome to the ECF staff room, Siobhan Goffey. It's lovely to have you with us. We should say to everybody that you and I are old friends. We used to teach together for several years in the same department, teaching the best subject out there, of course, which no prizes for guessing is history. You're in our staff room, Siobhan, so you've got to drink one of our coffees. I'm trying to remember, were you one of these cafetiere people? I think you might have been.
I was the cafetiere instigator. I bought the cafetiere abroad rather than the cafetiere into school.
And you take it black. You must take it black.
Depends on the time of day. Maybe a milky one first thing in the morning, but after 12, always black.
Very good. Very good. That's the most important question out of the way.
Welcome to the staff room, Siobhan. Mark and I are incredibly nosy, and we know our listeners are nosy too. And one of the things we love to ask people is how they got into teaching and what their careers are like since then. So would you mind just telling our listeners a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a reluctant teacher. I had an exit interview from my university with my tutor, which was probably the first time I'd ever spoken to my personal tutor. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, anything except for teaching, because it seemed like such a cliche for a history teacher to get a, you know, to just go straight into teaching. But I kind of went away and did some traveling, and I decided on this trip, walking around a volcano crater in Bali, that actually I thought I might want to do it. And then as soon as I got onto my PGCE, I've just felt at home. It felt like I kind of already knew what to do. And yeah, it felt like somewhere that I wanted to be. And that continued for, you know, quite a long time. So I was a history teacher, and then I did middle management jobs, head of department, second in faculty. But that wasn't really the direction I wanted to go. And at that time, you could become an advanced skills teacher. So that's what I did. And that kind of, for me, kept me in the classroom, kept me involved in the teacher development side of things. And that's where I worked with Mark. So because we were lucky enough as ASTs to be given a whole school kind of development remit. And that's probably the first time I did some coaching myself as a coach. I kind of felt that I could feel myself burning out in teaching. I went down to 4 days a week. And then I changed and moved to UCL worked across teacher training routes for history and as a professional tutor as well. And what was really interesting to me was I'd always assumed that it was being in school that kind of made me stressed out, made my work-life balance out of whack. But what I found when I got to university, where there was far more flexibility about how I spent my working day, I had a lot more autonomy, that I'd brought a lot of those things with me to the job. And I had a kind of, you know, we're going to get like, I'm going to start disclosing stuff now, but I had this moment in my office where I sat down and I was planning a lecture, and I'd done the lecture before. It was not a difficult thing. It was not something I'd struggled to do, and I couldn't do it. I had a complete and utter mind blank. which really, you know, was pretty scary. And I kind of realized at that point that what I was experiencing was actually anxiety. I would never have known that that was what it, I'd never have called it that. And I kind of, at that point, I realized I needed a big change. So I ran away to South America for a year, learned Spanish, traveled around, lived in Peru for about 6 months of that. And when I came back, I relocated to the west of England, to Bristol, and I knew I wanted to retrain. I didn't know what to do. So I was just thinking about like what I wanted to achieve and the fact that I still wanted to work with people. I wanted to support people maybe who'd had a similar experience to me. And so the skills that I already had were coaching skills. So I did a sort of intensive course over lockdown, in fact. But simultaneously, I went back and worked in a school, which was really interesting. And had that wonderful experience that every teacher who's been in their school for a while and has got it all sorted should have, which is to go into a new school where the kids don't know you. And, you know, I felt a bit like, do you know who I am? And the kids are like, yeah, you're the new teacher. We're going to treat you exactly the same as everyone else. So I'm kind of rambling now, but to bring it back together, I was quite convinced that I didn't want to work in education as a coach. And for two years, I kind of went round and round in circles. But what I was finding is most of my clients privately were teachers.
Yeah.
And the more I can't, and I was still working in, I'm still working in a school with kids, a great school. And yeah, it kind of just, I couldn't escape it. I was just like, this is kind of where my teaching, my coaching skills need to be, is with teachers, because it's a profession, you know, particularly post COVID, but let's be honest, before that, we're on our knees.
Such a fascinating story, and I'd love to ask you more about South America, but I fear we won't have time, so I'll have to ask you that after the podcast. But I'm really interested in, and I'm sure our listeners will be interested in hearing a bit more about the coaching program that you've started, because we know you run a coaching program called Partners in Joy, and I think the title of that, first of all, is something that really interests me. Could you just talk a bit more about that coaching program that you run and why you called it Partners in Joy?
Well, Partners in Joy is the name of me and another coach in education, Maureen Bowes, and she works mainly with primary rather and head teachers, and I was working a lot with secondary middle managers, and so we kind of had got the gamut. And I had been, the work that I'd been doing before I gave in and realized I needed to be coaching in education was around it was around well-being, but specifically around joy, around, and that kind of came out of the pandemic, and that's how we met. So Partners in Joy, we had a mutual friend, she'd seen my work. And she was just like, I feel like we could really do something together. So that was what we called ourselves, because that was our common interest. And what we both found was that teachers that we and head teachers and senior managers that we were working with, the thing that they came to us saying is just like, I don't really want to leave teaching. Like, I love it, but the joy's gone out of it. I can't seem to get to the bits of the job that bring me joy anymore. And so that's when we set up first the podcast and now the program, starting in January of next year, which is called Joy Blockers and How to Get Rid of Them, because it was really clear to us that there were certain key things that were blocking joy from the job for teachers. And actually, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that we've talked about, friends outside the profession have said that's the same in my workplace too. So yeah, that's how it kind of all came about. Finding joy in your job again and getting your work-life balance and the way you feel about your work.
We're going to talk a lot about that as we chat, Siobhan. One thing I wanted to talk about before that, though, is this whole thing about teacher identity and why that might be so particular about, you know, in teaching. And I'm going to invite you to tell a story that you talk about when you stopped teaching and you got into a cab. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what is this thing about teacher identity which grips hold of us so much?
Yeah. So I've been teaching, I think, 17 years when I changed and moved to the university. And it had all been in one school because it was a great school that had, you know, senior management with a vision that I could get on board with. And they provided opportunities for you to go where you wanted. So I had my leaving drinks. I left at Christmas. So it's one of those weird ones where it was like not even a proper, didn't even feel like a proper leaving do. And I went out with all my teacher friends. I had a lovely night. And I called a cab to go back home. And the cab driver, when I got in, you know, cabby conversation, said to me, "So what do you do?" And I just started crying because I was like, oh, my God, I'm not, I don't even know what to say to you now. I don't do anything. Who am I? If I'm not a teacher, who am I? And there's a couple of things about that identity, I think. One is that you're so in it, that you're so involved in it. Everything about it is relational, both with staff, other staff, and particularly with students and parents, especially in primary. So I think it got that kind of, it gets under your skin in that way. But I think also, I think it's still fair to say that you wouldn't join teaching if you weren't doing it for a reason, because you wanted to make a difference. And sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, I'm still in the habit when I'm talking to teachers of saying we.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I you know, and I haven't been teaching in a classroom for over 6 years, but I can't break that habit because it is so much. Actually, it's not just part of my identity. I'm just very proud of it. Mm. So do you have a word? I mean, obviously, you know, your career's moved on, but do you still relate to yourself as a teacher?
100%. I don't think it says it at the moment, but my Instagram account that I set up for my coaching business. You know, you're only allowed a couple of, you know, a few characters to describe yourself. Mm-hmm. And I got something about being a coach. And then the second sentence was teach to the bone, because like that, it just, it's in you, isn't it? I will always think of myself as a teacher. Same as my sister, who is a nurse, still calls herself a nurse, even though she's the bed manager.
You can't defrock a teacher, can you? but it is problematic, isn't it? I think there's this identification. It can be a problem, I think, which I think you'll be able to tell us a bit more about in the future in a few minutes. But Elaine, you want to say something more about?
Yeah, well, I was just going to identify with that actually, because I left teaching a year and a half ago now to work at UCL. But you know, I had that same sense of identity crisis, and the first thing was when it got to Sunday, and I wasn't sat down doing my lesson planning and a work. I was like, my goodness, I don't have any hobbies. What a boring person I am. So that was the first sort of identity crisis, and the second was I had a real feeling of guilt. Had a real feeling of, you know, I'm not in the thick of it. So does that even give me a right to comment? And then a sort of realization that I very unhealthily was living off adrenaline to the extent that I didn't realize. And actually then weirdly, I think I've become addicted to that adrenaline. And then I kind of missed it, you know, not that, you know, working with Mark wasn't sort of, you know, exciting enough. Obviously, it was a huge rush, adrenaline all the time, the excitement there. But, you know, I had that. I really missed that, because I think one of the greatest things about teaching is that sense of camaraderie, you know, the Friday night drinks, the sense that you've done it as a team. But, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword and can be incredibly healthy. And then, you know, the slight crisis that comes with identifying that, it just really chimed with me what you were saying about your feelings about that as well.
Yeah, it just the intensity of it, I think, isn't it? And I was just thinking about, now I'm gonna have to say it now, aren't I? But I was just thinking that sometimes teaching can feel like a bad relationship.
Yes.
Like when it's exciting, it's really good, but like actually sometimes it can feel a bit abusive and like, you know, like you're stuck in something that you know is not good for you, and Like nobody wants that. And I'm really interested in what you were sort of saying about that kind of feeling of adrenaline addiction, because what I realized for myself, where that anxiety was coming from, even when I'd left teaching, was that you are physiologically stuck in survival mode. Because there's in teaching, there is a constant sense of threat. So, and I don't say that to be, you know, to kind of be dramatic. I genuinely think that is how we as teachers exist. There's the you know, that you're keeping to a really strict timetable. Everything has to be done at a certain time. But more than that, there's just a pervading sense of toxic. What's the word I'm looking for? I've lost completely. Lost
toxic productivity. Is that your thing?
Productivity. Yes. Toxic productivity, that you must always be doing whatever the cost. And sometimes, definitely, that comes from the system and the sense of accountability that there is, especially since COVID. I mean, that has been ramped up, and for senior leaders, I mean, like, that level of accountability. They're frontline workers, you know, year heads as well, frontline workers. So, but yeah, there's that kind of that sense that if you aren't always doing, you are being lazy. And I think that the impact of that is that our brain is seeing that as a threat, and so we're constantly in survival mode, and all the adrenaline and cortisol and stuff that's going around our body that includes. And I imagine teachers as they're like massive heads dragging this like limp little body around that like barely exists, because we're that constant alert means we exist in our brain, and our body is telling us things all the time, like, you need a drink of water, you haven't been to the loo for 4 hours, you know, those kinds of things. And we ignore them, and we say to ourselves, I haven't got time to do that, which is obviously not true. It definitely feels like you haven't, but, you know, everyone can drink some water.
And the sense to which it's normalized, I think, is interesting, because, you know, if I ever said to my husband, come and meet us at the pub at the end of a day and sit with a group of teachers, his response would be, no, thank you, because it's really unpleasant for people that are not a teacher most of the time to sit with a group of teachers, because I don't think you realize how sort of normalized that is, and how those conversations leak out into even your social life and your time. And it's very hard for people outside that world to understand it, which can often cause problems with relationships as well for teachers, I think, in terms of well-being, because it becomes so consuming, and it's very difficult for people outside that world to sort of understand how stressed you are and why, you know.
And there's no stepping back and getting perspective. And one of the things you asked me when we were talking about doing this podcast was, why do people come to me for coaching? And all of the above that we've talked about are reasons, and many others, but the main reason people come to me for coaching is because to admit that you're struggling, or that you want to make a change within that teaching environment, is really, really hard. And there's some great like coaching that goes on in schools around, you know, kind of how to be a better teacher. You know, I think that can be done really, really well. But there are some things that if your line manager is coaching you and it's like, oh, do you need some coaching? Right, you know, we'll organize it with your line manager. You might not want to tell your line manager, I feel a little bit like I'm about to burn out. There's this whole thing of, like, you know, being worried about being seen as incompetent or weak. And sometimes you need an outside kind of ear to be able to admit that. We're not even admitting that stuff to our good friends at work sometimes, because it feels like too much.
You've got a great tagline for the podcast series, Siobhan. Stay well, rediscover the joy in the job you once loved, and stay motivated to change the system. You've got good naming game. I have to tip my hat to you. I'm reading some of the episode titles you have. What's good enough in a system where it's never good enough, the loneliness of the teaching profession, the virtue trap, the honor of self-sacrifice. So there's a lot of clues there, isn't there, about what you talk about in your program and what you've talked about on the in the podcast. But our the listeners to this podcast are mainly, you know, in their first or their second year of teaching, or they're supporting teachers at that stage in their career. So what would you say would, I mean, are new teachers especially vulnerable to this kind of overwhelm that you talk about? What is it about being a new teacher today, maybe, that makes them susceptible to poor mental health and poor well-being?
I think in some ways, yes, I think it goes across all teachers, but I think there's some particular kind of qualities of overwhelm that exist for new teachers. So I think, and it also depends on what route you've taken in as to where you will be with that. I think it's can be equally overwhelming, but in different ways. So I think, you know, if you've come through a university-based route, then that move to taking on more classes, teaching hours going up, being by yourself in a classroom, being in a new school that you haven't had time to bed into, those things can be hugely overwhelming. I think if you've come through a school-based route, you might be ahead on some of those things, but actually you might be burnt out from that first year because your teaching load was so much more. And on some of those routes, you'll be doing study as well as working through the ECF. So I think that, you know, it's kind of swings and roundabouts, but I think at that point in your first sort of full year as a trained teacher, there's that kind of idea of total kind of imposter syndrome of like, who's letting me be. I heard a friend talk about this, about taking a baby home, the moment when you've had a baby and you put the baby seat in the car and it's your first child and you take the baby home and you're like, why is someone letting me take this baby back to my house? I don't know what I'm doing. And I kind of imagine, you know, well, I don't imagine, I know, because I remember it. There's that feeling of like imposter syndrome. Every hour I'm in charge of another 30 students. You know, what you want me to write a unit of work, but like, I don't really know what I'm doing. So yeah, that kind of, that the imposter syndrome, and then that real conscious incompetence, where you realize all the things you can't do rather than acknowledging all the things that you can do. And I think, you know, there are some brilliant mentors out there that are really good at putting those things up the agenda in mentoring meetings and so on. But I think as a system, we're just looking at it like, I mean, that's how we're taught to as teachers, isn't it? Like, this kid's is their grades aren't where they should be. Yeah. Not well done for all those other kids whose grades are where, like, that is, that's how we operate. And I think the impact when you're already overwhelmed because you're doing something new and really massively challenging, I think that's huge.
Can I just ask a follow-up question to that, Siobhan? Because I remember the weight of responsibility really well, that feeling of being an early career teacher, shutting the door in my class and thinking, my goodness, I'm responsible for making sure these Year 11 students get good GCSE English results. And if I don't do that, if I fail at that, then I'm messing up their lives. And that weight of responsibility was probably the heaviest thing on my shoulders, I think, the sense that I would be responsible for failing young people. And I'm just thinking about what's changed now since I was at ECT many years ago. And now we know more and more about how students learn. And that's a good thing. So we have a more research-informed culture. And that can only be a good thing. But I sometimes wonder whether that has unintended consequences and can be a bit of a double-edged sword, if you like, because along with that comes, I think, more of a moral imperative of saying, well, if we know more about how students learn, then there's more of a moral imperative to draw on that research to make sure that those year 11s you're teaching, whatever subject you're teaching in, are getting good GCSE results. And I wonder sometimes if, rather than helping early career teachers, which is definitely what we want it to do, we want it to support them in their confidence and identity, sometimes it can add to that burden and have an unintended negative positive effect on their well-being. And I wondered if that's something you'd seen as well or shared.
Yeah, and I think to me that kind of links into the idea. So like, we're all striving for excellence because we're doing it for those kids. We want every kid to have every opportunity. And I'm not saying don't strive for excellence. Striving for excellence is a wonderful thing to do. When you strive for excellence, you fail and you learn from it and you feel good about that, right? But I would argue that for most teachers, certainly that I work with, and I think in general it's very hard to resist this, what they're actually striving for is perfectionism. And by its very nature, perfectionism has to be errorless. And so that means all the times you fall down and you fail, which, oh my God, like I remember my first year of teaching, I mean, not just the normal failures, but really stupid things that I did, of which I will not go into. But, you know, like mistakes you made, those things then, you're so hard on yourself about them. Because the expectation is that you will be perfect. Every single child that you teach will be reaching their target grade. And every single child by the end of the lesson will have will have reached all their learning outcomes. And, you know, that there's nothing wrong with striving to be the best you can possibly be. But that is not the same as trying to do everything perfectly.
There's external and internal drivers there, isn't there? So yeah, there's the system telling you that you've got these targets, the flight path that the child is on, you must reach. But I'm wondering if there's more to it than that, that this perfectionism is internal, isn't it? It's maybe even part of that identity you talked about before.
Yeah. And I think when you have a kind of moral imperative for doing your job, then that, at which teachers do, then the likelihood that you're going to fall into those traps and get just stuck in the pit of them. So I absolutely, Mark, there are external factors that drive it, but there are also internal ones that we do have some control over.
And it's interesting, because when I've spoken to ECTs on our programme and they've said, well, we've been getting very stressed out about self-study. And obviously, Mark and I, as programme leaders, we really care about the well-being of our ECTs, and we certainly don't want them to feel stressed out. We don't want this to have a negative effect on their well-being. And, you know, what we say to ECTs is review, tailor, tick. So, you know, review it, spend longer on the stuff you need to spend longer on and shorter on the stuff you don't, and never spend longer than an hour. But actually what some ECTs are saying is, no, but I need to do it all. And I need to write it all down, and I need to have everything written down. And it's really interesting that those well-being pressures are coming internally from exactly what you said about this need, that sense of perfection, rather than externally from the program. Often actually, particularly from what I've seen, sometimes in female ECTs as well, that need, that drive for perfection, that need to do it. I do see that trend there as well, which is sad and interesting at the same time, but it's definitely something I recognise. It's definitely something I recognise from working with ECTs in schools as an induction tutor as well, that often though that sense of well-being, those pressures came from them rather than something externally.
So it's really hard. It's hard for most teachers to set boundaries for all the reasons that we've just described. But particularly as a new teacher, to set boundaries, you don't know what boundaries you're allowed to have. And that also depends what's being modelled to you in your school as well, as like what, you know. But internally, if you are boundaryless, then you are going to be overwhelmed and burnt out extremely quickly. And so there's definitely some stuff there that you can do for yourself. So one of the things is about is the idea of comparison, and if you are comparing yourself to anybody else apart from just you, then that is going to lead you into a really difficult place. And again, that's not saying I'm not saying don't do your best, don't strive to get better. Of course, do that, but you can only compare yourself against yourself. The minute you start to compare yourself against other teachers, that way madness lies. And I remember that very distinctly, both as a new teacher and training teachers in school and at university, you're comparing yourself to people who've been teaching 5-10 years. But that's, of course, you won't manage a class in the same way that they do. Of course, you won't have that kind of the same vision for planning that someone with all that experience has. So I think that would absolutely be one of the things that I would say is really important, is only compare yourself to yourself in terms of boundaries. But the other thing is, what drives us to be boundary-less is that we want to do the best for the kids, and we want to be seen to do our best, just generally. But the choices that we make when we are boundaryless often have the absolute opposite impact on the students. And so if you are asked to, you know, if you're about to take on something new, have you seriously considered what the impact of that will be? Yes, there may be some good impacts, but what on the other side might be happening? You know, whose books aren't getting marked, whose lessons aren't getting planned because you do this new thing. So I think that is super important. And on a similar kind of vein, as a teacher, you are there role modeling what adults look like in a workplace, and this kind of absolute subjugation of self and toxic productivity is being modeled to a group of students. I'm kind of got my secondary hat on at the moment, but it equally applies to primary, who've just been through a pandemic and a lockdown, something we could never have predicted. So we then model to the potentially most stressed generation that has ever existed, like how to have no boundaries and work ourselves into the ground. And that's it's super important that we model ways of having good mental health to those students, because I work with these students and, you know, a lot of students are really unwell as a result of what they've experienced over the last 3 years.
Is there a message here as well from mentors and the often young new teachers that they're also that they're working with? Because you know, I know I've heard you talk elsewhere about you know, millennials, and about how that they're also maybe unusually susceptible to, because they're maybe because of how they've been raised to tune into their emotional selves more than the old sort of you know, old dinosaurs like myself who've never looked at his navel once. Is there a message here from mentors about how they also model?
I was just thinking about that before I came on, like about how challenging it would be to mentor an ECT around their own well-being, because the best way to be successful in that is to do the things you think they should be doing. And what we often do as we mentor people is we see they're stressed and we try and suck it up for them so they don't have to do it. And that is, you know, it's absolutely well-meaning. I have 100% been that person doing that myself. But what you are modeling is something unsustainable. And so all those things that I said for ECTs are obviously is important for any teacher.
Can I just ask a question about boundaries? Because one of the things we talked about is it's so hard to recognise when you're sort of got into that cycle of toxic productivity. You know, I would say there's times I definitely did that, and I wouldn't have been able to sort of step outside myself at the time and recognize that, even when people told me, actually, you know, it was very easy just to mask it and say, no, I'm fine. And, you know, you do that. So what advice would you give for ECTs to sort of tune into their well-being and make sure that that doesn't happen? I mean, how can you know whether you're going too far down that road or not?
I think the clues are all there in your body. And if these little increments of time can be really small, like something as small as recognizing, oh my God, here it comes. I can feel it, like my stomach, my throat's tight, my stomach's churning. Like everyone has their own signs of overwhelm. I think I go through quite a long list of them in the podcast on overwhelm, but you need to get back in touch with your bodies and feel when it's coming and know that that is a moment that you have to take a step back. It might be for 2 minutes. It might be taking 3 or 4 deep breaths. And like the difference, the things that can happen in a few breaths, like going for a difficult conversation, you're going in totally keyed up, like fists clenched, stomach churning, like adrenaline high. You stop for like 2 minutes before you go in and breathe. Like that could be the difference between a disastrous conversation and one that is much easier to have. But we don't even give ourselves that. So I'm not here to say, just manage your time better. You know, like, no, definitely not that. We're talking about finding tiny things, tiny moments. And then the really small boundaries, like stuff when you're going home, you know, just saying to the people that, I know it's not, if you've got kids, you might need to actually sit in your car before you go in the house and have your 10 minutes taking a breath, like doing something before everyone needs you. But like just having that moment to go, I'm going to take 5 minutes, I'll be with you. Or like if you're in the middle of a task and someone comes in and they want something for you, oh my God, I mean, we know that happens in schools, poor yearheads with a queue of people waiting to talk to them. So saying to people, I just got to get this finished. I'm just in the middle of it. Let's what time's good for you after 3? Because I'll be done by then. And in terms of mentoring, those kinds of things are really important when you're trying to carve out your time with your ECT.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I'm just reflecting on this. One of the best pieces of advice I ever had from a mentor was, Elaine, lower your shoulders when you're in the classroom. And actually, you know, it wasn't you need to give better questioning, or, you know, maybe don't plan a drama activity on a Friday afternoon. That was a disaster. And it was actually just, honestly, it was lower your shoulders. And I didn't realise until a year in that I was clearly walking around the classroom because I was so stressed with my shoulders hunched up like that. And actually the act of my mentor feeling about that and lowering my shoulders, I suddenly relaxed. I suddenly, it was like an epiphany for me. It was suddenly like, oh, no, I should be relaxed in the classroom. And if I model that I'm relaxed, that's going to have a impact on my students. So it's really interesting what you say about drawing our attention just to how we're physically feeling in the classroom can have a big impact.
Lunch. Stopping to have your lunch. Mm. How many teachers do you see eating their lunch at 4 o'clock? Like, I know there's masses to do, but even 10 minutes eating your lunch and actually what you're doing is eating your lunch. Like, that's massive. So at the school that I now coach at, I did supply there, I mentioned before, and I had a really difficult timetable. I was teaching across 8 rooms. And it's on different floors, and I was carrying it was a nightmare. And they still have a staff room that's well used in that school, which to me is a sign of a good school. And at the end of my second week, my head of faculty came up to me and said, I haven't seen you in the staff room. What's going on? And I said, I just can't get up there. Like, I've got, you know, like all these rooms. And she was like, fine, that we can't have that. Like, you have to socialize and you have to have time out. And she changed my time, she changed the rooms. You know, and I'm not saying that like every school has the capacity to do that, but like to prioritize that made such a difference to me. I felt so valued.
Well, that leads me on to my next question, which, you know, there's a lot of criticism about wellbeing initiatives in schools, such as, you know, you're a bit stressed, here's some cakes for you so you can eat your feelings, or, you know, do a yoga class after school when you haven't got time to do a yoga class. But, and you kind of alluded to this, that what can senior leaders in school do that has a more meaningful impact on well-being? And that was a really good example you gave, just in terms of thinking about rooming. But what would your advice be to senior leaders who really want to support ECTs and teachers more generally in school?
I mean, like, what I would say is, or I would clearly say this, but like having someone external to be able to do some of your well-being stuff makes a massive difference, because it gives people permission to talk about things they don't want to talk about. So I think that is absolutely money in the bank. But clearly, I would say that. But I think it's the same thing again about boundaries, isn't it? It's like, what will be the impact of adding this thing on the you know, both positive and negative? That's one thing. I don't know, anything that brings people together and allows them to actually talk. Do you know what I was thinking of? Maybe this is more for mentors and senior managers, but asking how are you twice. Like we're English, aren't we? We say, well, no, so I beg your pardon, we are not English.
Wash your mouth out, Siobhan Duffy.
So sorry, Mark, forgive me. But you know, that whole kind of polite, how are you? And everyone just says, yeah, good, yeah, like that. And then, you know, at the beginning of your line management report or whatever, right, and also, how are you? And people will smile ruefully, and then they're much more likely to tell you. We do, you know, those tiny increments of time are worth their weight in gold.
So being quite proactive about that well-being check-in and making it more than just that superficial how are you, I think that's really important, and recognizing how difficult it would be for people to tell you if they're not okay. So reading the signs on that.
Yeah. And I'll leave it at that because I'm rambling on now.
Siobhan, you said you spent 17 years teaching in the one school, but in the years subsequent to that, you've been in lots and lots and lots of schools, mm-hmm. in your ITE role and talking to lots of teachers, of course, who work in lots of different schools. And I know that you've talked about elsewhere that you feel that certain things have changed since the time that you were maybe first teaching or in that first school you worked in. And you've talked about sort of a loss of creativity as we centralize lesson planning, that opportunity for a teacher to express themselves individually through their own and also just express what they know about the children in front of them by planning the lesson for those children, that somehow we've kind of reduced that somewhat. And the other thing you've talked about is, and you've mentioned it already today, is this whole, you know, staff room loss, that there's been a trend, we think, hasn't there, of away from a room just about big enough to squeeze every teacher into it, to a proliferation of phase or departmental workrooms, with the emphasis on the word work, of course. Are you just a sort of old history teacher who just lives in the past, Siobhan, or is there something real here? Is there something that we should be mindful of here?
I just, the casualties of a culture of toxic productivity are joy, creativity and community, because it's this idea that those things are soft, that, you know, they're not measurable. We can't tick them off to show we're doing a good job. And they, you know, like, you should just push on, you know, like, we're doing this for the kids. You must sacrifice every bit of yourself for the kids. And I just think some of the reasons that we joined the profession were things like being able to plan creatively for your individual students with the knowledge of your class. Mm. And what we haven't mentioned at all is the teacher retention crisis, which is huge. So things like, you know, kind of off the peg units of work that everyone uses and you just pick up and go can be really welcome when you're struggling. But they're not going to bring any joy into your teaching. They're not going to help you to be a good teacher because you're not demonstrating your understanding of the way that kids learn. So I mean, you know me. Mark, I am an old lefty, and I would definitely say that, you know, this kind of, there's a kind of a marketization and accountability. If we want everyone to be accountable, we want to make it easy to make them accountable. And so we do things in a way that makes that easy, but that the soul then leaves.
Yeah. There's a reason we call this podcast the ECF Staff Room. It's not accidental. You know, Elaine and I are both wed to this notion that, you know, staff room is a great place to actually the community, absolutely the community, but also, frankly, it's a great place to learn, you know,
exactly,
professional learning. And I hope I would be remembered from the staff rooms I spent. I was kind of a staff room guy. I spent a lot of time in staff rooms. I always ate my lunch in the staff room. I spent a lot of time obviously working with new teachers because that was my role more laterally. And I part of it was I wanted them to see that you could do that, that didn't matter how busy you were. And I was a pretty busy assistant head. I would sit in the staff room as well with take my little box of sandwiches out and eat them. And I think that's pretty important. But so it is a bit modeling, but it is that community, but it is also about learning. And you don't go to the staff room for a hug necessarily when things go bad. You want the hug, and then you want the, and you know, you might try this or you might try that, or, and it might be research informed, or it might just be the oldest teacher in the staff room who's seen it all before, and I want to listen to that person.
But it might be something that you celebrate, where someone comes in and goes, "Oh my God, I tried this new thing. It's amazing." And someone goes, "Are you doing it again? Can I come and see it?" Like that stuff, that should be organic. Shouldn't need to be organized at a certain point, and then everyone feels under pressure. "Oh my God, I've got to teach this amazing lesson because this person's coming to see it." Those things need to be organic. And when we set up that, when we're setting up our program, we had that exactly what you've described in mind, the idea of bringing people together for support, for accountability, but also for learning. You know, that all of those things are hugely important. I don't know. I just, when you're stuck in your workroom, in your faculty, where, you know, hopefully everything's going well, but where there might be some difficult relationships, that is not a place for fertile learning about education.
I would say when I was ECT, there were two things I learned from the staff room. One was to laugh at myself because I had such a great group of colleagues. But I would go in and say, "Oh, I did this lesson, I put Play-Doh in because I thought I'd teach the kids about imagery. And actually what happened was I just spent 20 minutes picking up the leftover pieces of Play-Doh from the carpet and no one learned anything." And, you know, I'd learn to sit there and laugh, and people would gently mock me for that. But actually it wasn't just laughter that I was learning. And that's healthy as well, because you should be allowed to make mistakes in your workplace and should be allowed to learn from them. But what I learned was how to fail well. Yeah. And I think you need to be able to learn how to fail. And I learned not to take myself too seriously. And actually what was normalised within that staff room, what I learned was that it was a safe space for people to go in and say, "Oh, I can't believe you did that," or "You did that." And it wasn't that we had low professional standards. You know, we all care. We cared passionately about the students that we taught. But it actually normalised for me that it was OK to make mistakes and learn from them. And that's what that staff room culture did. And I think the other thing that staff room culture gave me was a sense of debate, because we'd sit there and have lunch, but we'd also debate things, you know, and I would kind of, I think, shape my teacher identity against that, because, you know, I'd almost be playing with the different hats and identities in terms of what I thought. But that would be quite healthy for me to hear a range of opinions within the staff room, and actually that it didn't all have to be the same, and that actually one person could go off into their classrooms and teach like that and still be a great teacher, and another teacher could teach like that and still be a great teacher. And I think that they're two very healthy things that were normalized for me within that staff room culture, that they are important as part of the growth of a early career teacher in a way.
And there's just one more thing that came to me that I was thinking about, that, like, one of the things that's a really common thing that features in the podcasts and in the program, because it is something that comes with teachers to coaching sessions so often. And that is that idea about the way you talk to yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, in a staff room, you're taken out of your own head, out of that inner voice that can be so critical and so cruel. Like, if people could see, I think I talk about this on one of the, I think Maureen mentions it, one of the podcasts, if you're, what you said to yourself in your head appeared in a think bubble and people could see it, you would not want them to know what you'd said to yourself. And when you are sitting alone in your room, your workroom, your classroom, whatever, and all you're doing is funneled into your work, that voice can get out of control. Mm-hmm. and that your body doesn't, or your brain doesn't know the difference between someone saying that to you, like someone shouting in your face and calling you an idiot, and you doing that to yourself in your head. So the physiological response is exactly the same.
That's really interesting, because I think if I hadn't have gone to the staff room after that Play-Doh lesson, I might have sat in my own classroom and thought, I'm a terrible teacher. Why am I? And I had those moments as well. Why am I doing this? I'm not helping anyone. I can't do this. But in the act of going to the staff room, in fact, I started off like that, but I came out with, well, I made a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes. I can see the humour in it. It's okay. And actually, we're agents of our own classrooms, and I can put it right tomorrow. So this is okay, you know.
And someone will almost certainly go, oh, do you remember that time I did this? And the other person will go, oh, my God, yeah. And then you realise you're not alone.
Yeah, the pitch sticks are still stuck to the ceiling from the last time I handed them out. Yeah.
Mine were never good enough to stick to the ceiling. In fact, I could never find any pitch